Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Travel Department. Experience travel the way it's meant to be. Fully guided and extraordinary.
Now, my first guest this morning gets no long introduction to his own guests. They just sit down in front of him and off he goes. Comedian, TV host and podcaster Tommy Tiernan, good morning to you.
Father, husband, brother, uncle and granddad.
In all of those. You look great. I'm just thinking you look really rested.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't feel it. I'm in a permanent state of pressure. I'm a buzz hunter. I need stimulation. So I lurch from caffeine to collapse. That would be the state of my life, really. I get up in the morning, I have a double espresso, then I meditate for half an hour. So you've got the two extremes there already. Then I might have a cigar at 9:30 and I'll try and come up with some ideas for stand-up. And then I might have a snooze and then more coffee and then sugar. So I'm on a fairly active elastic band of tension and release all day and for most of the night. I take statins because my heart is... It's a genetic condition that the Tiernans of Athlone have. Our hearts are full of so much love that it's sometimes impossible to pump it all out. So the arteries aren't big enough for the love that would be in us. And so I have to take statins to widen the arteries. But they make my legs. I have that jumpy leg thing. So I thrash in bed and I snore quite profoundly. So
does Yvonne mind?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. She hates it. But for you to say that I look rested is must be the lighting, but because I would never say I'm that.
But like you were calm because you come in here today and you got a flat tire on the way from Galway. But you said that really calmly. I would find that stressful.
I was shouting at inanimate objects for about 20 minutes when it happened, but they didn't respond. So I realised the futility of that, and then I tried to accept it. And I kind of came here via Google Maps on the phone, which I've never done before, and I got lost in UCD.
As you do.
As you do. So, no, we're here is the main thing.
Would you mention the Tiernans of Athlone and your dad, Kevin, is alive and well and hearty. He is the Tiernan from Athlone, isn't
he? Yeah, there's a great brood of them. There's five siblings, all still in it.
Good genetics there.
Great genetics. Brian is 85 going on 86. My father is going on 80. My father's 84. And then there's Emer, John and Maura. And they are the type of, they're a very welcoming brood. They're a social brood. They're a porter clan. They are up for and well able for drinking and talking. And my Uncle John just released his first collection of short stories called Telltale Townie. Magnificent writer. But they're a very genial bunch. So I have that mix of, I come from that, but I also come from the dark blood of Tipperary. Like there was somber stuff flowing through the O'Briens.
Your mum Helen.
Yeah, there was a much more, there's more thunder in that part of the country than there is where my father grew up. So I'm a mix between the two, I think. The kind of the ability to be genial, but also the inclination to get savage dark at times. So they both flow through me.
Both obviously super talented people. I was obviously Googling you, Tommy. So you were born in Carndonagh.
Did the Google tell you where I was lost in UCD?
Not today, funny enough. But you're born in Carndonagh, yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
So do you say you're from Donegal?
No, I don't. I'm one of those people, and there aren't a huge amount of us. We're not from anywhere.
Okay.
So, and it's because we're like skipping stones. We don't really spend an awful lot of time in any... I'm longer in Galway than I'm anywhere else, but only moved there when I was 20. And I earned my living on the road. But I lived in my beautiful wife.
And she is beautiful.
She can say, I'm from Rathfarnham. My children can say, I'm from Galway. But I was only 3 years in Donegal, then I was 3 years in Africa, a year in London, a year in Athlone, 9 years in Navan, 2 years in Ballinasloe, Do you know what I mean? I was on the run. I was on a witness protection program and I was only a child. I don't have that sense of being, I have a very strong sense of being from the island of Ireland, but no place in particular. And I love the road. I love it. I love driving around Ireland. The momentum of it and the ever-changing scenery, and to have the moral courage to pull off the motorway and drive the old road from Galway to Dublin. And it does take moral courage, because you have to, you opt out of the rat race, because you're, you know, people say, oh, I'll be there in an hour and a half, 2 hours. But you go the old road and it's four and a half. Longer if you pull into Tyrrell's Pass for sandwiches. So, but I love that. And I get great, I find great relief in movement. Constant movement. It's where I'm happiest, actually, when I'm moving.
And would you opt to do the long route to Galway?
I try to, but like I said, it takes courage. But every time I do it, I'm so glad I do it. There's great slow winding roads, and if your car has hips, you just kind of, you swing from ditch to ditch. It's delicious.
And would you listen to podcasts or to music?
No, I try to, after a show, I'd listen to music, because it takes me a while to come back to myself. But more often than not, I try to have no noise in the car.
At all?
Yeah. I try to. If it's a Sunday morning and I'm driving home now, I'll listen to this.
Of course you will.
I'll always check Joe Duffy.
Yeah, definitely.
Just to see what's going on. Just I don't need much of it. And sometimes he gets me for half an hour, but oftentimes I just want to hear who's complaining about what and what's wrong with them, and the depth of it. Because sometimes Joe can be like bone deep, graveyard deep. It can be, you know, the soul of the country. He could have it in his fist, and he'd be trying to, you know, heal. But other times it'd be people who didn't get their tuppence back from the shopping trolley in Dundrum. And you'd be going, oh, Jesus, am I done? So I say no. But the vast majority of the time it'd be silence. That's what I'd try to do anyway, you know, or Bob Dylan or someone, you know.
Is that because you also like to meditate? I wouldn't like silence in a car, funny enough, because you'd be with your own thoughts all the time.
Yeah, it's more to do with, I think, preparation. Because often when I'm driving somewhere, I'm on my way to do some work. So if it's a gig, it's about letting the thoughts of the past couple of days settle. So you're not filling your imagination with other thoughts. You're just kind of, you're sieving through what you have and just letting, and getting notions and then driving to the far side of them.
Yeah.
You know, like deciding on an approach to an interview. And then by the time you're in motion, you see the futility of the idea. And you're back to yourself. So it's, you're giving yourself time to get over yourself.
I like that.
In silence is what I've found, I think.
But you do meditate every morning for half an hour, do you?
Mostly, most mornings, yeah.
What do you do when you meditate? Do
you just sit, you...
Where are you physically doing it?
I have a shed down the bottom of the garden, or I sit with I fell into a group of Zen Buddhists based in Dublin, and I love them, actually. I think it's a marvellous, I wouldn't even call it a religion, it's a marvellous technique. So they have an online sit every morning from 7 to 7.30, and I just find it magnificent. I love the ritual of it. All rituals are daft. They make no sense. But I love the rituals in Zen Buddhism, the bowing and the bells, and you surrender to the form. So you kind of, in the way that water will fill whatever shape of a bowl it's in, you allow yourself to go, fall into the shape of the Buddhist ritual, and it holds you. You know, I'm not into mindfulness, really. I find that too, it's not gimmicky, but it just feels a bit transient to me or something. Whereas the meditation connected to Buddhism is 2,500 years old. So I feel held. I feel as if wiser people than me have passed through it and have left advice. And I feel minded by that. But the actual, you know, there's no dogma, really. There's no, And you are just sitting in silence. There's no, I'm not, you're not trying to levitate or manifest wealth. Do you know, you're just looking at a wall going, oh, here I am again.
But when you were a young guy in school, isn't this right? You were quite religious. I mean, you did even, or think about the priesthood. I mean, you're always quite religious or spiritual or both.
Or whatever that is, that thing we all are. If you have an imagination that hasn't been colonised by entertainment, you know, and if you're reared in this country pre, you know, 2011, you'd have some sort of awareness of a religious background or something. So, yeah, I think if you were back in those days, I think I met a fella. I was in the Vatican.
Would you have recently?
I was in the Vatican, and
as you are,
it's a great place to be a gay priest. It is a great place to be a gay priest. Most of the art is homoerotic. It's a lot of semi-naked men, muscles, and sheets draped around their productive regions. And a lot of people would have joined the priesthood in the 50s and 60s and 70s, fellas who were gay maybe, and then and they said, if I join the priesthood, I'm not going to have to answer the question, how come you're not married? That question would no longer be asked of me. And if you're good at poetry as well, you had to, that's half religious anyway. So, and I think that, how did I get onto this particular? We don't know. Anyway, so I'll keep going and see where we end up. So I was in the Vatican, and I was very, I would say that my Catholicism or my love of the Christian story received a big boost. You know, it's the art is magnificent. The intention of Catholicism is gorgeous. Do unto others as you would do unto me, in so much as you did it to the least of my brothers, you did it to me. Love one another as I've loved you. The intentions of that are so gorgeous. So when I was about, we had no religion in our house growing up. A nun nor priest never darkened the door.
That's unusual.
We weren't made go to mass or any of that type of stuff. And then when I was about 14 or 15, I just thought it was a radical alternative to what was being proposed to me by the education system. I thought, wow, this is different because it's offering a kind of moneyless life, a love life. And I thought that was incredible. And then I got into the Waterboys and stuff like that. And it was, you know, that was very spiritual as well. And you too were kind of spiritual back then. And so I went to join the Redemptorist priests, and I got talking to this fella. I can see him in my mind's eye now. God knows what has happened to him. He had rosy red cheeks, like somebody from Kilchamah or Cross Malina. Do you know, they're kind of soft.
Yeah, lovely, kind of, like, healthy.
But a kind of like dark black hair, pure white skin, and rosy kind of red cheeks and ruby red lips, and he was about 19 or 20 years of age, and we just got talking one afternoon, and he says to me, I have a devotion towards Our Lady. And I just said, I have to get out of here because I have no idea what that young fella's talking about, and in many ways I still don't, but I knew that I knew myself and himself didn't belong in the same organisation. So for someone of 19 years of age in 1989 to say to me, I have a special devotion towards Our Lady, I just had no comprehension of what that meant. So I left.
That's so interesting though, A, that you thought about it, and B, that you left. You're still pretty spiritual today though, aren't you? I mean, I know you've spoken about going to the Vatican, but it was an amazing experience to go there.
Yeah, it was, but I wouldn't say I'm any more spiritual or religious than anybody else. I think we all carry this, just that my imagination drifts there more often, maybe. And I love books about Jesus. I love them. And I love the stories of the Bible, and I love kind of hipster theology. I'm very, I wouldn't be able to go to Maynooth and get a degree now, but I'd sit in the Pepper Pot Cafe and talk about how God's presence also contains his absence. Like, I'd knock 10 minutes out of that. But I think we all have it.
Mm.
You know, we all have something, whether it's a hope or... and I shouldn't even be trying to describe what I think other people have. It comes very natural to me to be interested in religion.
Mm. And you love Joyce, don't you? Do you still have that tattoo? Mm. His quote from Portrait of the Artist on your...
She was walking on before him, her hands holding her skirts up from the slush. And I got that tattoo, I would say, about 25 seconds after I met my wife. Not literally, but when I met her, it was kind of like being on ecstasy or something. I've never felt so upside down and loved and high. There's a great phrase in Irish, "Fui yasa," under a spell, you know. And I definitely I fell tremendously, catastrophically, dangerously in love. And it felt like you're in love with somebody kind of sounds like it was you're doing the experience a disservice. But I was very vulnerable to it, I suppose, in a way, because I never had that. My mother and I really were, we were associates rather than lovers, if that makes sense, you know. I think when I met Yvonne, something, I don't know, it was like a part, it's like a chakra that had never opened in me, opened or something that I wasn't able to control. And then I was going for a walk maybe, and I saw this written on a piece of hoarding outside the James Joyce Centre. She was walking on before him, her hands holding her skirts up from the slush. And I just thought, I didn't even have to think. I just went into tattoo parlour in Temple Bar and I said, will you put that on my arm, please?
Did he know it was a Joyce quote from Portrait?
I'm sure I must have told him. I can't imagine he was impressed.
Probably not. Listen, Tommy, I want to come back to your mum and your dad and your relationship with them. Two really different people. So stay with me. We'll take a break.
Tweet at Miriam O'Callaghan.
Welcome back. Well, Tommy Tiernan is with me still. I want to ask you more about your mum, Helen. You mentioned her earlier. And I want to come back to Kevin, your dad, too. A lot of times, Tommy, I find when I interview people who maybe had tricky relationships with their mum or their dad, over time, they kind of reflect back on them and they think more kindly of them. Has time altered your view of your mum or not?
Yeah, so just because somebody dies doesn't mean the relationship still goes on. Mm-hmm. I suppose what I am aware of recently more than I've been before is what she might have been like as a young girl. But there are no answers. There will be no resolution to this. Not that there's any resolution to any relationship. But there'll be no, I'll never get to the end of it. And all you do is, I don't know, I can't put a shape on it. All I can do is answer questions. If somebody says, did this ever happen? And I can say, well, no, or, you know, I have no way of figuring that relationship out at all. And when you grow up in a particular dynamic, you take it for granted as a child because you're kind of robust, and if it's always been the norm, so you kind of you adapt. And it's maybe when you see how other fellas might have gone with their mothers that you kind of go, I had no idea that was even an option. So you know, I can testify to the strangeness of our mother. You know, my sister Anne, who wrote a book about it, The Last Days of Joy, where it wasn't about our mother in particular, but there was the ghost of my mum ran through it, you know. So, I'm talking a lot here without actually saying anything. So, and I think that's the nature of it. I don't actually know, Miriam, to be honest with you. I don't I can't put a shape on that.
For anyone listening who doesn't know, I know your mum, she took her own life in 2010, but you know, she probably adored you all. Like reading about her, she was like setting up women's refuges, wasn't she? She was amazing to everyone around her. And like, she was a remarkable woman in her own right.
Her sister committed suicide as well. So it's a funny one. So I can tell you that our house, in terms of our relationship with her mother, was a tough house. It was one without any physical affection. But my mother, once she stepped outside the house, Jesus, she was like St. Francis of Assisi. Do you know what I mean? She was the mother Teresa of Navan. Like she would take other people's children and mind them. And so it was that, I think once the door closed, I think she just heated up and couldn't cope.
Yeah.
But once she was out the gap, like it was setting up refuges and herself and a couple of friends of her, a lady called Maureen Owen, who in a way was, I kind of got a lot out of my relationship with Maureen. She was my mum's best friend. They set up this refuge for battered wives in Navan when they were asked not to by the church. They went ahead and did it. This is the early 1980s.
Courage.
Yep. So you have that dynamic going on. But, you know, my mother doesn't just belong to me. I mean, other people have had their relationships with her. She did other fantastic work. And I'm not sure how important my relationship with her is in the whole scheme of things. You know, I'll gallop on.
Yeah.
You know, I'll gallop on.
Your dad, meanwhile.
Yeah.
Kevin. Sounds amazing. Was he a lecturer originally? What does your father do? So is he a comedian?
No, but they're all amazing storytellers and talkers, the Tiernans. So again, I'm piecing together, so I don't know everything. So as far as I know, my father got a job in the tech in Carndonagh, teaching religion and science. Imagine that. 1968, teaching like the two, could you find two more oppositional subjects? So he taught religion and science. And then something occurred around 1972 where families from Carndonagh were airlifted out of Donegal and brought to Africa. There was some strange deal with the African government done where, because we weren't the only family, there was like four or five families who just were dropped. We were dropped in Kabwe. We were there for 3 years.
Where is that? Zambia?
Zambia, yeah. So my father got a job with African farmers. Doing what? That's an excellent question. I have no idea. Talking to them, leaning on gates. And then we lived there for 3 years. My mother got a job in the local primary school where she was my teacher, believe it or not. And then we moved to London for a little while. And then Athlone, and then Navan, and then on and on and on and on.
Wow.
But if I ended up like my father, I would have made some good decisions.
Oh.
My father has a magnificent gentility to him, a magnificent wisdom, a soft soul, and a great man for a pint. He'd treasure conversations and porter and a laugh. And if I end up being that gentle when I'm his age, I'll have I won't mind turning out like him.
You sound like you love him very much.
Ah, yeah. I told him once. I told him once. There was porter taken, and I got a rush of blood. I was about 22 or 23, and I said, "I love you," and he said, "Sure, why wouldn't you?"
You didn't lick it off a stone, Tommy.
So yeah, no, he's a gift of a father, really. Lovely.
That's so lovely. Do you still have the two dogs?
So yeah, so we have a Bernese mountain dog called Archie, who's beautiful. He's a big soul. He's very good company. And I love him very much. We have also have another dog who is a Labradoodle, and they're kind of, we brought him to the vet recently for anti-anxiety tablets. He's nuts. He's not well, but they're bred not to be well. He's a cross between a mop and a panic attack. He has no, there's no peace in him. Everything agitates him. And we brought him to the vet and we said, did we do something to this dog because he's not right? And the vet said, no, they're bred to be like that. They have too much cortisol. So he's on a course of antidepressants now. He's probably, he listens to Joe Duffy in the afternoon just to... He lies there on the windowsill with the radio on, just smoking a cigarette, looking out the window. So they're the two dogs that are in our lives at the moment.
Good. You're starting a chat show?
Chat show starts again in January, yeah.
It's so good.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's a brilliant idea, isn't it? You have a lovely team as well, by the way.
They're great and they're proud of their work and rightly so. And they know that they're doing something that has jeopardy in it. And they know that we're all the time being pushed out of our comfort zone. Mm. And I'd be lost. I mean, the way I see the chat show is they get the ingredients and they bring it to me and I cook them. Mm-hmm. And then we give the ingredients to the editor and the editor decides how the food is presented. So it's not just me. But I think the type of conversations that we have on the show, I think people are relieved to hear them. I feel as if a lot of those conversations kind of take place on radio anyway, but they don't really happen on television. And I think that people are... That bit of you that's always disappointed at television, that bit of you which knows you're being sold a pup when you're watching TV and you kind of, you know, you put up with it. That part of you, I think, when it sees the type of conversations that can happen on our show, is relieved and pleased and kind of going, oh, thank God.
Because there's nobody plugging anything normally. I think that's it.
Yeah, and that the conversations can wander.
Yeah, you're also brilliant at it, let's be honest.
Well, I mean...
You listen to people.
I listen,
listening.
Yeah, you've no choice. Mm. You know, and I'd have the... I don't know if it's the courage, but I'd have the strong inclination just to follow my instincts and if a subject comes into my head to ask people about it. So I'd... so it's worthwhile.
And you've got the podcast up and running again with the fab Loretta and Hector.
Yeah, so
that's a great podcast.
Yeah, so we're doing two more episodes of that for Christmas. One was recorded in my hen house and one we recorded yesterday, which will be released next week, I think. We went to Doherty's pub in Ballina and we had 3 pints each and it was the first porter that Loretta had taken since having the baby.
And the first Lola, beautiful Lola.
The first drink I'd had since July. So we got giddy and stupid and we recorded a kind of a porter chat. And I also have a solo podcast, which is called Private Investigations, which people can check out, which is just me rambling through. It's kind of like this, except you're not here.
So, sounds perfect.
No, but not to me. But yeah, so Private Investigations is a solo podcast that's out as well.
Now, finally, your shows. I mean, is it 17 shows you're going to do in Vicar Street?
Yeah, but I'm also around the country as well.
Yeah.
I mean, I have the stand up is hard, you know. It's kind of how would you even describe it? It's not casual. And a huge part of my imagination I think I'm a born talker and a born storyteller. So I exist with other people through the medium of story. Those stories don't always have to come in the form of stand-up. They have done up until now. There might be other ways of doing that. So part of it absolutely suits me. But part of me is well shook by it as well. And this happens as well in the podcast with Loretta and Hector. When I'm looking for the funny thing to say all the time, and you can get childish and immature and silly and crude. I often don't like that part of myself. You know, I often, because you're kind of, you're making yourself very vulnerable because you're not being clever and you're not protecting yourself with wit and you're not armoured in any way. You're kind of being a fool. And I find the afterwards of that hard. You know, I I do. It's like, even yet, like, I was driving up today thinking about some of the stuff I said on the podcast yesterday. And I was going, who is that Egypt? Like, who? Do you know what I mean? So I find that hard. But I'm once a friend of mine gave me great advice for stand up. He said, prepare meticulously. So I do. I have a, say it's a 90 minute show or something like that, and I could have 17 or 20 stories or topics. So I look at each of them before I go on, and I remind myself of what the stories are. And then he said, once you step on the stage, abandon all preparation. Mm-hmm. And I do. And that's where it gets silly. And that's where I lose control of myself. And that's where I say things that I regret. And that's when I'm a bit mad. And that's hard to deal with. In the moment, it's high. In the moment, it's wild. You're the boldest brat that ever spoke. And you're saying, what? Oh, God, stop. And you're filled with that kind of stage bravado. And you're not afraid of anything. And phrases and sentences are flowing through you. And you'll say the thing that nobody, no. And it's out your mouth and people are laughing. And they're delighted that they're there to hear it and not to take responsibility for it. And then they're drinking and they're walking home. And then you're on your own going, who would say those things? Do you know? So I find that's the part of stand up that I find difficult, you know.
But it's not me who's just saying this as we close. I mean, everyone I was speaking to, Tommy, and not just Billy Connolly, but about you today, you're regarded as a comic genius. I mean, you are. And you must know that. Even if you find it hard and afterwards you doubt yourself. I mean, anyone who sees you on those shows, I've been to Vicar Street and watched you. You're a genius up on there.
I mean, I have... That makes no difference.
Fine, do you get nervous? It's a boring question, but do you get nervous now before you head around the country and get up on the stage, wherever you are? Do you get nervous that moment? Just like for me, it's the red light, but the minute you go out.
I don't know if nervous is the word, but I'm definitely in a state of agitation. And it is, to be honest with you, once it begins, you're in that persona and that kind of rhythm, and it's fine. It takes care of itself. I was talking to a great comedian one time. I can't say his name. A great comedian. And he says to me, my favourite part of the show was when I say good luck, good night, I'm out of here. And I never want to get to that stage where I'm more relieved to be off stage than on. That's it. I suffer from something. I wouldn't say it's nerves. I think it's more worry and agitation, I think, before I go on a show.
I love talking to you today, Tommy. For the people listening, you're not just a comic genius, you're a lovely guy, and I was really pleased to have you in today. The TV show is back on RT1 TV on the 4th of January. Your Tommedian show and tour continues all over the country, as you said, including Vicar Street. Your podcast is going to be available for Christmas. Everything and all details for all you do, Tommy, is on tommytiernan.ie and Tommedian on Instagram. Tommy, thanks for being my guest.
Thank you so much, Miriam. What a treat.
My privilege.